Thank you. We are still in the 15th catechesis of St. Cyril in the 9th paragraph. You remember, last time we analyzed what the saint. We are still in the 15th catechesis of St. Cyril in the 9th paragraph. You remember, last time we analyzed what the saint, the prophet Daniel, prophecies concerning the abomination of desolation. But the sign of desolation, as we said, in its final form, its third phase, is the Antichrist. The first phase, we said, is Antiochus Epiphanes, in 168 BC, who treated the Jews terribly and had the statue of Olympian Zeus brought into the temple of God, the temple of Solomon. Then the Romans had brought in the statue of Caesar, of Caligula. And the third and final phase, because Daniel does not exhaust the characteristics of the Antichrist, of the abomination of desolation, in the antitypes of the Antichrist. Rather, he exhausts them in one person who has not yet come. And this is the Antichrist, for he gives marks and characteristics which, at a first glance into the prophecies of St. Daniel, you will see are not exhausted in his antitypes. They are exhausted, however, as we see from many other passages of Holy Scripture, in the person of this future abomination of desolation, and that is, as I told you, the Antichrist. Still, one very characteristic and very illuminating passage, despite certain obscure points that exist, is the analysis, or let me say, the description given by the Apostle Paul. It is in the second epistle to the Thessalonians, in the second chapter, between verses 3 and 10. What he writes to us there is extraordinarily important, as I told you, and very illuminating. Although, I repeat, there are also certain obscure points which we cannot clarify very easily. Yet these things were not unknown when he wrote his epistle to the Thessalonians. For he says to them, "Do you remember that I told you this, and that, and the other?" But today we do not know what he told them, and so he does not describe more, and certain obscure points arise for us. Here, writing about this, the Apostle Paul gave a clear sign, saying that that day will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of perdition, the one who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Do you not remember that while I was still with you I told you these things, and now you know what it is that restrains him, so that he may be revealed in his own time? For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will destroy with the breath of his mouth and abolish by the manifestation of his second coming. His coming is according to the working of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, with every deception of unrighteousness among those who are perishing. Very briefly, let me render it for you in a somewhat free translation. The Apostle Paul, says St. Cyril, gave us this clear sign. What sign? That if the apostasy does not come first, and the man of lawlessness is not revealed. The man of perdition, of destruction. The man who is opposed to God, the man who exalts himself above everyone else. So much so that he will surpass everything in history that is called God or worthy of reverence, and will even come to sit in this very temple of God and show that he is God. Do you not remember, when I was still among you, that I used to tell you these things? And now you know what restrains him, the restraining thing, an obscure point, so that he may be revealed when his hour comes, the Antichrist. For the secret of lawlessness is already at work. I am not saying mystery, I am saying the secret, only when the one who restrains, another obscure point, like the first, is removed from the midst, then the Antichrist will appear. And then the lawless one will be revealed. But the Lord, when he comes at his second coming, that is, immediately afterward, will destroy him with one breath of his mouth, meaning very easily. That is what the breath of his mouth means. And he will abolish him, all his activity, by his own manifestation and coming, that is, by his second coming. As for his coming, the coming of the Antichrist, it is not that Satan becomes incarnate, but it is according to the working of Satan, with every power, with every miracle of signs, and with wonders. Great miracles, yet false ones. With every deception of unrighteousness, false things, but in the end these will turn against those who are perishing, those among men who are to be lost, those who are not written in the book of life. This, my beloved, is a brief rendering, so that we may see that the Antichrist will not come unless the apostasy comes first. That unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness, the son of perdition, is finally revealed, the Antichrist will not come. And if the Antichrist does not come, Christ will not come. Historically, the matter began in this way. There was a mistaken interpretation of Paul's epistles. In his letter to the Philippians, in the 4th chapter, he writes, "The Lord is near, be anxious for nothing." He did not mean by this that we should not take care of anything, that we should not cook, that we should not cook, that we should not eat. But the Thessalonians had misunderstood other points from the apostle as well, both from his oral teaching and from his written teaching. We say written today because we know what he wrote. The oral teachings we do not know, they have not been preserved. What had he said then to the Thessalonians? They misunderstood matters, and it seems that they misunderstood them even while Paul was still present. That is why the Apostle Paul says to them, "Do you not remember what I told you? But what shall I tell you? Shall I give you a clearer example? I will give you a strange example." It is well known that in the early church, the idea spread that John would not die, the evangelist. This circulated that John would not die, because Christ had said hypothetically to the Apostle Peter, when the Apostle Peter asked how John would end his life, for they were friends, "I will die as a martyr, as you tell me, but John, how will he die? What is that to you?" If, let us suppose, I wished him to remain, that is, to live, that is, not to die, until I come again at my second coming, I do not know why that concerns you. I told you what concerns you. What does John have to do with you? And so, it spread in the church that John would not die. And John, who writes last in his gospel, clarifies it. He did not say that he would not die, but, "If I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? If, hypothetically, I wanted him to remain, not to die, what is that to you? Do you believe it, beloved?" Despite this clarification, to this very day there are people who believe that John never died, that he is hidden away somewhere by God, and that he will be one of the two prophets of the apocalypse, the book of Revelation. Wrong. A grave mistake. Here in Arda, there will be people who believe this. I will not name what they are. They believe it, once. In a calendar, one of those calendars from banks and organizations that put pictures in them, I saw such an image, where they were burying St. John alive, and afterward John disappeared from the tomb. These things, my beloved, are not correct, despite the clarification. Immediately there is a misunderstanding. So, the Apostle Paul's words were misunderstood while he was still in Thessalonica, and he explains them. When he left, they remained with the misunderstanding. And what did they do? They did not go to their jobs. They were, he says, not working, but meddling. They went about saying, "What will happen?" Like what we say today, "The Antichrist is coming. What will happen? What will happen?" And he writes the epistle and says to them, "Do you not remember what I used to tell you?" So we do not know what he used to tell them. For this reason, as I told you, he wrote what he wrote. Nevertheless, there are many things the Apostle Paul writes to us here, as many as the Holy Spirit illumines St. Paul to record for us, so that we too may know. First the apostasy will come, then the Antichrist will come, then Christ will come. And because the issue, the real problem, had to do with the second coming of Christ, he says here that unless the apostasy comes first, in a certain way, the matter of the apostasy and the revealing of the Antichrist coincides. And rightly so, because I will explain this to you further down. Unless the man of sin is revealed, unless the Antichrist comes, Christ does not come. He will come after these things. I said, coincide, because the Antichrist and the apostasy, we might say, are both distinct and identical. For the apostasy exists, but the culmination of the apostasy will be the Antichrist. Therefore, the apostasy is distinct from the Antichrist, and yet it is also identified with him. For the last fruit, the highest fruit of the apostasy, will be the Antichrist. Let us not forget this. So let us look here at where he speaks about the apostasy, but because further down he gives an analysis of the apostasy, not right here. That is, when St. Cyril analyzes the passage of the Apostle Paul, and because he says quite a few things, Let us look at this subject a little further down. But now let us see here how he speaks about the Antichrist. He says, "And the man of sin is revealed." One word at a time, is revealed. I told you this last time, and I will repeat it once more. When he says, is revealed, it means he appears. Although before this we did not know of his presence in the world. Let me give you an example. Last time I gave you the example of a statue covered with a flag. Now I will give you another example. A teacher in a school has taught a pupil. At some point, in fact, he has a class, the sixth grade. He has had them since first grade. At some point, when they want to put on a celebration, and he wants to include some songs, especially solos, he tries out the voices. You sing for me, now you sing for me. He notices one pupil with a voice like crystal, a masterpiece. My child, you are a revelation. He knew the boy, but he had never known his voice. Now it is revealed that he has a voice. My beloved, the Antichrist, as we shall see, is a man. He will be born. He will live among other people. His presence will pass unnoticed. And at some point, when he begins to take up the action described for us by the Word of God, then through his action, people will recognize that he is the Antichrist. So the word revealed was not put there by chance. The verb to reveal was not put there by chance. What I am saying is directed against that idea, as I told you last time, that the Antichrist has already been born, that he is a certain age, that he performed this or that miracle in Jerusalem. These things are not right, and I think this point is a chief point, because many have been troubled by the thought that if the Antichrist is already here, present in life, some saying he is 15, others 22, others 27, and that his activity will appear when he is 30. Then what is left? 15 years? No. 8 years? No. No, my beloved, please pay attention at this point. Things are not like that. And the man of lawlessness will be revealed. He will be a human being. There is another view here, a mistaken one that many people hold, that he will be some kind of incarnation of Satan. They told me about this, though I don't know it and I didn't see it myself. A film that was shown at one time, one of those satanic films they put out, horror films, films of fear, and so on. The film was showing that Satan was going to become incarnate. But it is impossible for Satan to become incarnate. Whenever he appears as a man, or whenever demons appear as men, it is only an apparition, a phantasm, never a real taking on of human nature. Satan may appear as an animal, a dog, a beast, thunder, lightning, whatever you like, the devil can make such appearances, and an angel can do the same. But the angelic nature, and likewise the demonic nature, cannot achieve incarnation. Incarnation is the unique and exclusive prerogative of the one who brought about his own incarnation. That is, the Son of God, who created the world, he alone is able to become incarnate. But since the Antichrist will certainly not be the incarnation of Satan, then he will be a man. From a mother and father, that is what it means to be a human being. For even Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God become man, has a paradoxical birth as well, that is, a birth from a virgin. But the devil cannot become man. The Antichrist, who will act according to the working of Satan, as we shall see a little further on, will be 100% human from a mother and a father, fully and properly human. Now, how is this man described by the Apostle Paul? The man of lawlessness, a man of lawlessness. The names are names that characterize, as is always the Hebrew custom. What is lawlessness? John the Evangelist says. What is sin? Lawlessness, what is sin? My transgression, or rather my evil stance toward God. My stance that is not pleasing to God. When does this happen? When I do not keep his law. Therefore, sin is lawlessness. When I do not keep the law of God, I sin. Very simple. We understand it. So the Antichrist is called the man of lawlessness. What does this mean? It means that he will not keep the law of God to the highest possible degree. There are many lawless people. The lawless are a multitude. In our hymnography we say, the lawless Jews, when we refer to the matter of Jesus Christ. The lawless, lawless, is anyone who does not keep the law of God. Here, however, this lawlessness takes on very deep dimensions. Dimensions it has never taken in any human being. Daniel helps us with this. He tells us that the Antichrist will change laws and times. This phrase, that he will change laws and times means he will alter the laws. You may say to me, when we say, I alter the law, does that mean that instead of you shall not commit adultery, I then say, commit adultery, because I decriminalize adultery, or because I consider fornication to be nothing? Is that not an alteration of the law? Yes, it is an alteration of the law. But do not forget that, before the Antichrist, we have the spirit of the Antichrist. In other words, we already have things maturing, so that we may reach the culmination. But when Daniel says he will alter laws, it means that a new understanding of law will be created, one completely different from that which God has appointed for humanity. When he says laws in time, or times in a time, in the singular, if I remember correctly, what does time mean? It is interpreted as nature. Daniel uses this verb, he will alter. He will not only alter the laws, he will also alter nature. How can we understand the alteration of nature? Let me tell you, it is very simple, very, very simple, when we regard homosexuality as something entirely natural. What is that? Is that not an alteration of nature? And even worse, when we take two men and marry them, not simply because they commit a sin. Listen, my beloved, homosexuality, homosexual conduct has always existed. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed for this sin. For this sin, they were destroyed. Homosexuality has always existed among sick souls. But when it reaches such a point that it is regarded as the most natural thing, so that it does not scandalize, let us say, or shock anyone, this means that we now have an alteration of nature. But the crowning point of this alteration of nature is when I legalize this condition, not only by making laws that leave people free to commit the sin openly, as we have such things now which were not demanded by the EEC, that freedom should be imposed, let us say, that freedom should be given to homosexuals and that it should not be a punishable offense. Beyond that, not only this, but even a kind of approval, reward, and crowning of the thing. How, you know, when the church marries two people, it places two crowns on them. The two crowns do not constitute the mystery, but they are an act of the church showing that she crowns those who come at that hour to be married, because they manage to struggle in the arena of chastity and to win. That is, they remain pure until their wedding, and the church crowns them. You will say to me today, are all those who are crowned pure? Well, it is a parody. Each person will feel the parody within himself, and will lament his own wretchedness if he did not guard himself until the moment of marriage. But the church crowns, pay attention now, and now someone comes and crowns two men who are being married. These are not fairy tales, the newspapers write about them, and not just this year or yesterday, but for some years now. The mayor of the city in England, this happened. This particular case was in England. The mayor of the city, at the request of the two young brides, a fine couple, even grants them an apartment in the housing complex. As we have apartment blocks here, public housing blocks, he gave them an apartment too, everything sweet as honey. And worse still, a pastor, always a Protestant pastor, marries them. We have even seen in a photograph, a pastor marrying two dogs, in a photograph. And a pastor, that is, a priest, though a Protestant one, marries two men. There, that clipping you left me here earlier, which writes about a woman from the press, the first woman priest, who marries a couple. This, of course, little by little, you understand. Although the history of our church has no woman priest, such a thing does not exist. And since this clipping raises such a question, I will answer that question now, to settle it as well. Our church, in her tradition, has known no such thing. Christ gave the right of holy orders to no woman, to absolutely no woman. Neither in the Old Testament do we have a woman priest, nor in the New Testament, nor anywhere along the whole length of our ecclesiastical history. The phenomenon appears for the first time 20 centuries after Christianity, that is, after the birth of Christ, 20 centuries later. And this means that things are degenerating more and more. So, for a priest to reach the point of marrying two homosexuals, this is now not an alteration of law, but an alteration of nature, so that you may understand. Let me put it to you with an image. How does all of this come about? We have a certain intuition that we are at the end. But how does one determine when the end is? Not tomorrow, of course, but in any case, at some beginning of the end. for the history of humanity cannot be drawn out very much longer. You remember, at one time, when we were speaking about and interpreting the things of the apocalypse, I had told you something, and let me say it to you again, in just a few words. The time from Abraham to Christ is 2,000 years, about 2,100 years. The prophecies that speak about Christ do not hurry his coming. They do not hurry. From Christ until today, we have 2,000 years. We are about to complete the 2,000 years. The prophecies that speak about the second coming of Christ are urgent, so the end cannot be very far away. You see, then, that this is not arbitrary. It is simply a supposition, an intuition, but not completely arbitrary. It rests on something, and also on what one sees. For example, I once heard a broadcast in which the speaker said that our age is entirely new. The age of humanism is now ending, he said, and a new age is beginning, which he called by whatever name he called it, and he said many things. It is an age that has many characteristics, such as the characteristic of anarchy, and so on and so forth, many, many things. As I listened, I said, this is the age of the Antichrist. The age of humanism leads to the age of the Antichrist. Humanism means making man the measure. Do not let the word deceive you. It means arranging human affairs on the basis of human reasoning and not on the basis of the divine words. In other words, it is a repetition and culmination of ancestral sin. We will become gods without God. Isn't this exactly what the devil said to the first formed ones, to Adam and Eve? You shall become gods without God. And so I, as man, will attain theosis, my divinization, through science, through technology. I will arrive. I will become. I will become. Or I will display my love for mankind. Or I will build human societies that are peaceful, where there will be no war, utopia. It is utopia, my dear ones. Thank you. All these things are called humanism. Human reason is put in the center, a repetition of ancestral sin. But since ancestral sin has been emphasized further than in any other age, it follows that when this age closes, the age of the Antichrist will open. What matters is that this has been noticed, as was said, by the philosophers of our age. The speaker said that the age of humanism is closing and a new one is beginning. But philosophers, as people of this world, cannot grasp anything of what the Spirit of God is working within this world. Spiritual people, however, do perceive these things, they do grasp them. And this is the period of the Antichrist. For when he tells you that the New Age has such characteristics, what kind of characteristics? He speaks to you about anarchy, he speaks to you about strange things. All these are nothing but elements that dissolve a society. They cannot be elements that hold a society together, but elements that break a society apart. So, beloved, the Antichrist will be the culmination of lawlessness. As I told you, lawlessness has been very widespread. He will be its high point, and he is called the Man of Lawlessness. This is a second title given by the Apostle Paul, the Son of Perdition. Pay attention. First, he says the man, now he says the son. We would say the Son of Man. It is always a Hebrew expression, just as Jesus Christ also has the title, the Son of Man. And Christ himself gives this title to himself. The Jews say to him, who is this Son of Man? In Greek, we would simply say, because the expression is Hebrew in form, a man, and Christ wanted to emphasize his divine nature and his human nature. Here then, the apostle, in order to emphasize only the human nature, says the man of lawlessness, the son of perdition. But there is one more thing. The word behind perdition means destruction, loss. We say, I've lost my wallet. It is why the police have a lost and found for missing things. Lost, forgive me for going into such dense detail. But I do this so that, if possible, even a small child may understand me. Perdition. Perdition does not mean annihilation. Just as we say the water was lost from the cistern. It was not destroyed, it evaporated. It went somewhere else. But lost does not mean it became nothing. The water went somewhere else. So when we say that a man is lost, it does not mean he is annihilated. The expression perdition means the darkness of hell. This is what it means in the language of Holy Scripture. It is the darkness of Hades, and then of hell. Christ called Judas the son of perdition. Lord, my father, he says in his prayer, I have lost none, except the son of perdition, who is not lost by me. He chose it himself. Do you see how the Lord calls Judas the son of perdition? Now, what does son of perdition mean? It means two things. The one who destroys, and the one who is destroyed. He is a son who destroys men. That is, a man who destroys men. And in the end, he himself is destroyed. This is why the Antichrist will destroy many more than world wars have destroyed. And this destruction does not mean that they will be put to death. No, he will destroy in the sense that he will send them to hell. In that sense, he will destroy. Not in the sense that he will kill the martyrs of Christ. But he himself also will be destroyed in the end, because the book of the Apocalypse tells us clearly. And here too, the Apostle Paul says that the Lord will destroy him with the breath of his mouth, that is, very easily. By his second coming, he will destroy him. And the book of the Apocalypse tells us that he will be cast alive into the lake of fire. What does alive mean? This shows something very important. I explained it to you then. Perhaps we have not noticed it. It is known that the people who will be living at the second coming of Christ will not taste death. We who are left, says the Apostle Paul, in his first epistle to the Thessalonians. The two epistles to the Thessalonians have two chief themes. The first, the resurrection of the dead. The second, the Antichrist. We who are left behind, the living, says the Apostle Paul, we who will still remain, will not taste death, but we will be caught up into the air. That is, we will be taken up to meet the Lord, to encounter the Lord. But what will happen to the corruptibility and mortality of human bodies when Christ then appears? They will be changed into incorruption and immortality, for the godly and the ungodly alike. So then the Antichrist also, since he is the one whom the second coming of Christ will destroy, or the second coming of Christ will destroy, this means that he will not taste death, and it means that he will be changed. We shall be changed, says the Apostle Paul, from the mortal state of the body into the immortal, and from the corruptible into the incorruptible. And the sinners who will be raised, and those sinners who will be living, the former will receive their old body. But resurrected, while those who are living will have their body changed into incorruptible and immortal, and they will find themselves in hell with their body. And consequently the Antichrist too, since he is a man, for he is a man, will find himself in hell. Now hell, not Hades. That is why it uses this small word, the Antichrist, it says, and the false prophet will be cast alive into the lake of fire. Therefore, here please, allow me to say something, and do not tell me I am being overly detailed. These details must be examined carefully. There is an interpretation, as I told you once before, that between the Antichrist and the second coming of Christ, there will be 1,000 years. It is not only the millenarians who say this, no, but also some modern writers. Indeed, one contemporary theologian writes this in one of his books. You will see it if you ever read that book. I will not say more. I will only tell you that no interval of time intervenes. The mind of the church, that is, the interpretation of the church, says that no interval intervenes. The 1,000-year kingdom is the time enclosed between the two comings of Christ, and it is called the time of the gospel, as St. Andrew of Caesarea says. And the other fathers say this as well. But you see, by his second coming Christ will send the Antichrist and the false prophet into hell while they are alive, but they will be alive when human nature has already been changed. If they had to die, they would not go alive. Pay attention. If the Antichrist and the false prophet had to die, they would simply die. Then they would not go alive. They would go as we do, for we do not go alive to Hades. The soul goes to Hades, and our body is in the grave. So when it says here that they will be cast alive into the lake, it means that this change will take place. But the change will take place at the second coming of Christ. Therefore, no interval of time intervenes between the end of the Antichrist and the second coming of Christ. I believe this is clear, and it is as I am interpreting it for you from Holy Scripture. It is clear, very clear, and it agrees completely with the teaching of our church on the question of the 1,000 years. So, son of perdition, the third title, the adversary, the one who sets himself against. You know that the word Satan is a Hebrew word, Satan, and it keeps its Hebrew form. Paul uses it there in his letter to the Corinthians, where he says, there was given to me an angel of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted. You see, an angel of Satan. And even when the word is translated into European languages, it stays as Satan. They don't turn it into Greek. They take it over, just as they take over, hallelujah. It is a Hebrew word. And what does Satan, that is, Satan mean? It means the adversary, the one who resists, who sets himself against the will of Christ, against the will of God. He is called Antichrist because he resists Christ and appropriates Christ to himself, the titles of the Messiah. He is called the opponent because he appropriates the titles of God and stands as the adversary of God. That is why he is called the opponent. If we had to say it another way, since here the Apostle Paul says it in Greek, we would say Satan. But he rightly says the opponent, because someone might perhaps say, and become confused, that maybe this is Satan himself. No. But who will he be? A man whose life has been identified with Satan, and whose conduct is the conduct of Satan, you know. For a man to identify himself with Satan 100% is terrifying. There is no man, my beloved, up to this day in all of history, even the most terrible, the most filthy, the harshest, the most fearful persecutor of Christianity, the most heartless man who ever appeared in history. Believe me, no one has reached what the Antichrist will reach. That is, no one has reached the point of being identified with Satan. No one. So you understand what a fearful person this Antichrist must be. A fearful person, the opponent. The fourth description is the one who exalts himself. This is the one who exalts himself. To exalt oneself means to be proud, to set yourself above everyone else. Eromai means I rise, I lift myself up. Hyper means above the others. And this is exactly what pride is. I appear above everyone else, or I want to appear above everyone else. But this pride of the Antichrist will have no precedent for the antitypes. Antiochus Epiphanes, the Roman emperors who deified themselves, and so forth, did not reach this point. My beloved, Caligula placed his statue in the temple of God. The Antichrist will not place his statue there, as I told you last time too. And it does no harm if I repeat some things. He himself will sit in the temple of God. Therefore, the Antichrist will have surpassed every predecessor of his. He will have surpassed every antitype of his. This is fearful. And pay attention here, so you may see. And exalting himself above everything called God or object of worship, he will stand higher than everything that in history is named as God or as an object of reverence. For example, what could be called God? Zeus, or the true God. Or an object of worship. Perhaps this stone here. We venerate it. Yes, it is revered. He will stand beyond and above all things. Because he will stand beyond and above all things, I must tell you that idolatry, which is a machine of Satan that he cast into humanity, because the first symptom of the fall of the first formed was idolatry. The first chronologically and the first qualitatively is idolatry. Idolatry will return toward the last things, eschata. The Apocalypse says this. When the angel says to John, the beast that you saw was and is not, and shall be idolatry was, with the second coming of Christ, it is not, but it will return. I must tell you that the devil is working through idolatry, but when the Antichrist comes, he will abolish idolatry. For since he will stand above everything called God or object of worship, he will therefore abolish idolatry. He will abolish it in the name of God. That is where people will be deceived. But in the end, he will proclaim himself to be God. So idolatry stands in his way. Pay attention to what I am saying here. Idolatry stands in his way. Could this be the restraining thing, the thing that holds him back? We shall see, because in the word katakon, the one who restrains, and the thing that restrains, these are participles. One is masculine, the other is neuter, ho katakon, two katakontos, two katakonto, two katakon, two katakontos. From the verb katako, to hold back, many interpretations have been given. Because this is an obscure point. Could it be idolatry that is holding him back? When idolatry disappears, the Antichrist will be revealed. Let us say that this is one interpretation, one of them. Perhaps it is not this, but perhaps this too. I go on. So that he sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. That is, so that he reaches the point of sitting in the temple of God and proving himself to be God. How will he sit there? How will he sit, as I am sitting now? Will he sit on the bishop's throne? We cannot easily grasp this. We cannot easily get hold of it. What is this temple of God? The fathers tell us that it is the temple of Solomon, which he will build. You know this. You have heard it elsewhere, too. You have read it. But will it be only the temple of Solomon? What about those who prepare the Antichrist? The spirit of the Antichrist, represented by certain persons, the so-called Antichrists. John the Evangelist says, "You have heard that the Antichrist is coming, and even now there are many Antichrists." He distinguishes the Antichrist from the Antichrists. The Antichrist represent the spirit of the Antichrist, while the Antichrist is the main person himself. Could they also sit in the temple of God, meaning in this temple? I have nothing more to say. I refer you to the interpretation given by Arthas. You know, I have already said some of these points in the lectures on the Apocalypse. I am simply repeating them. Those of you who remember will recall them. Arthas, who interprets the Apocalypse, says, "Could it be that the Antichrist is also sitting in that very temple of Constantinople? What does he have in mind when he says this?" Pay attention. He is writing in the 10th century. The Antichrist where? We would say in the city of Orthodoxy, in the temple of God. Let us say in the temple of Hagia Sophia. Can the Antichrist sit there? He has heretical patriarchs in mind. This is not the Antichrist in the strict sense, but the Antichrists. How many heretics have sat on the throne of Orthodoxy? Until yesterday, I will say nothing more. Or rather, until today. It is not the Patriarch of Constantinople. We are simply saying, historically, that this is the Patriarchate of the Ecumenical Patriarchs. I will not analyze the ecumenical question further. Do we not have patriarchs even today who are heretics, who would like to accept ecumenism? Take this as an example. The events of our own time are moving quickly. Those of you who read even a little know these things. So could it be, Arthas says, that the Antichrist also sits in the temples of God, not only in the temple of Solomon, but in the temples of Orthodoxy? Saint Cyril says, it is the temple of Solomon. We shall see this. But not this year. Do you know why? I am sorry. The 15th catechesis will not be finished. With our minds already on the ascension, we shall not finish. But you will have patient endurance. I want to gather you again next year so that we may continue. So pay attention here. All these things are true, and he will prove himself to be God, a fearful thing. How will he prove that he is God? The Apostle Paul will tell us at the end, with every power, according to the working of Satan, with every power and signs and lying wonders with astonishing miracles, even to the point that he will raise a dead man. As the book of the Apocalypse tells us, one head of the seven-headed beast was wounded and put to death, and the Antichrist, it says, raised it up, and then they worshiped the image of the beast. But these things will be illusions. Beloved, do you understand what a fearful person the Antichrist is? But since the hour is ending, let us look at one more point about this. Do you not remember, says the Holy Apostle Paul, that when I was still with you, I told you these things? When I was with you, I used to tell you these things. And now you know the thing that restrains. And now you know that which holds him back. What is it? The Thessalonians knew it then. We do not know it today. What is the catechon? The restraining thing. A little further on, he will tell us, so that he may be revealed in his own time. That is, when his hour comes, the Antichrist will be revealed. Catecho means to hold, to restrain, for, he says, the mystery, the secret of lawlessness, is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. Who is this one who restrains, beloved? Many interpretations have been given about this restrainer. I explained earlier. Some said it is the Roman authority, the Roman emperors, who even deified themselves. But in the way they governed their state, they did not allow the rule of certain others. A simple interpretation. Others said this. Others said that. I will tell you only what John Chrysostom says, who for a moment says that it is the Roman state. But what can I say? Listen, John Chrysostom, for his part, says that the restrainer is the same thing as that which hinders. That is, that which holds back and prevents. What is it? O Oecumenius says. They gave the name the restrainer to the decree of God, and Theodore of Mopsuestia says, this restrainer. The apostle names it the decree of God, his appointed limit. This means that it is the decree of God. In other words, my beloved, God is preventing the Antichrist from appearing until everything reaches its appointed end. This is the boundary set by God, until the plan of God reaches its completion. And when the plan of God is completed, then God will withdraw, and the Antichrist will act. This is the one who restrains. I say again, if you find another interpretation elsewhere, it is because there are many interpretations. But we cannot say that these things happen apart from God. No, God has a plan. Let me give you a parallel example. It just came to me now. You know that the Hebrews did not enter the land of Canaan. They remained 40 years in the desert for many reasons. And also because God says to Joshua, to Moses, the time has not come for me to destroy them. Because the time has not yet come, we might say, for the cup of injustice to be filled. Can we say, then, that these things happen apart from God? No. God has a plan. Let me give you a parallel example. It just came to me now. You know that the Hebrews did not enter the land of Canaan. They remained 40 years in the desert for many reasons, and also because God says to Joshua, to Moses, the time had not yet come to destroy them, because the time had not yet come, we might say, for their suffering to be filled up.